Welcome to Podcast on Fire 156, the Keith Vitale interview, part one. And I'm going to be brief with you here and just leave some contact information because the separately recorded interview sets it all up, and it's that very interview you came here for, not my pre-interview babble. So this is Podcast on Fire at the Podcast on Fire Network. Go to podcastonfire.com for this, all the other shows, and the bonus episodes. Email for feedback if you like this interview, please tell us, podcastonfire@googlemail.com. tell us on Facebook, facebook.com/POF network. On that page you can find the link to our discussion group, so join the discussion and all the fun. Or you can search Podcast on Fire Network in the Facebook search box and that'll get you the group. And follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/podcastonfire. I do my writing at sogoodreviews.com, category free ninja exploitation, Taiwanese black cinema, what have you. And join me over at sleazykvideo.com for the video reviews that accompanies the main reviews that I post every 2 weeks. And follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/sogoodreviews. Subscribe to the Podcast on Fire Network and Podcast on Fire specifically on iTunes, and if you like the show, please leave a rating and a little comment. That would very much be appreciated, and thank you everybody who has done so far. And if you don't like downloading podcasts to your preferred device, you can stream us via Stitcher. Download the application to your iPhone, iPad, Android, or BlackBerry, and that application is free. And once you're in Stitcher, type in Podcast on Fire Network and that'll get you the option to add each show individually. So, on to the interview and hope you enjoy. So, welcome back, listeners. And before I let my guest introduce himself, one of many steps that I, as a podcaster and movie watcher, should attempt is to broaden my horizons, to viewers and fans and myself, really, they urge me to watch more films, and it works better when I'm doing it for a show, as work for a show, when an interview is on the horizon, for instance. And it's the latter purpose that it's why I watched a bunch of films this week, and therefore joining us today, tonight, or whenever you're listening to this, is actor, producer, fight choreographer, writer, and Black Belt Magazine, Black Belt Hall of Famer, Keith Vitale. So say hi.
Hello, Ken. Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. That sounded pretty impressive.
Yeah, it's a little insight into what I do personally, and certainly it's really a minor introduction to you, and will build upon the legacy of a legend, if you will, during this conversation.
Well, I look forward to talking with you, and I've been looking forward to this because I have a full history, a lifetime of wonderful events, and would love to share them with your listeners.
Excellent. We'll touch upon those various stages of your career, but just to briefly remind listeners of this show, which is a show that mostly focuses on Hong Kong cinema. So if I were to remind listeners what they might have seen you, Keith, is probably most would answer Summer Hong's Wheels on Meals. Okay. But I will add to that many movies, but aside next to that, I would place movies like Revenge of the Ninja. So we will get into it and kind of start from the beginning here. So can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into martial arts specifically?
Well, I was a distance runner in track. That's my background. Mm-hmm. I played a lot of sports, ran track, received a scholarship to a university in Charleston, and was a distance runner. I ran the mile run, I ran cross country. So the fortunate thing about being a distance runner is I put a lot of miles on my legs. I developed a phenomenal cardiovascular, I had lungs. And so all of this was a great prerequisite for my martial arts. I hadn't even entered it yet. Mm-hmm. And then one day, after my first year in college, a high school friend of mine attended the University of South Carolina, came to, and he wanted to introduce me to his new karate instructor. And believe it or not, it was 1971. I had never heard the word karate before or didn't know anything about him. So we got in the car together. I drove over to the university. I met John Roper. He's a Korean instructor. Uh-huh. And I met him for the very first time. I watched two people spar and immediately fell in love with the martial arts, fell in love with karate. There was a small guy. His name is Joe Fracavieri, and he was fighting a taller guy who was a blue belt named Bruce. Uh-huh. Now, again, this is going back to 1971, and I watched the fight, and that small guy, about 5'5", was holding his own. And I went, I love this. I saw kicks for the first time. I saw movement, and I just fell in love with it. I spent 2 weeks getting myself acclimated to it. I came home. I called up my university in Charleston, told them I wasn't coming back after the summer. I was going to enroll in the University of South Carolina so I could start participating in karate. So just imagine, I dropped the track scholarship, paid for my college, and went and paid for my own college so I could take up karate. And loved every second of it. I took 2 years. Now get this. I took 2 years to get my black belt, but my Korean instructor was so disciplined and so tough as a very disciplined instructor. He was very old school, and I remained a white belt for 1 year, 1 month. Uh-huh. And every time I would even hint about taking a test for the next belt, the green belt, he would, get upset. So I remained a white belt one year, 1 month, probably the longest in history, because just imagine, when your friends are asking you about what you're doing and how are you, we heard, you know, your friends say, we hear you taking karate. A year later, you have to tell them you're still a white dude. And they go, oh, that's nice. But they realize you're... Well, in that 1 year's time, we were at University of South Carolina. I'm in Columbia, South Carolina, which is a hub for military bases. Hmm. And we have military personnel from around the world who come into the University of South Carolina to fight. And this is going back in the early 70s when schools competed against school, where they would just come in like the old kung fu movies, and they would challenge school members. And I was always the one that my instructor would have fight the visiting black belt coming in, regardless of where he came from. Hmm. I remember I took so many beatings. Gear would not be invented for another 7-8 years. And so when the fighters would come in, I would have to fight every fighter coming in. And but this, by the time I received my green belt, 1 year, 1 month later, I had broken, sparring with people, I had broken 52 people's ribs, 52 different people's ribs. Wow. With my sidekick. My sidekick, I just honed and perfected and worked on, and by the time I got my green belt, I knew I could keep anybody off me with my sidekick, and I was a sidekick specialist, and I was 6 foot tall, 150 pounds, and I just had a phenomenal dynamic sidekick, and then as I progressed and got my black belt in 2 years. You know, I didn't think I was really that good. I was in a Korean-based karate program called Taekwondo, mm-hmm. and then I entered my first karate tournament. It was called Battle of Atlanta in Georgia. So I drove there. I entered my tournament, my first one. I fought 8 fights. My first 7 fights went okay. I made it to the finals. I fought a guy named Bobby Tucker, who was a phenomenal fighter. He had been winning grand championships for years already. And he defeated me on that tournament. But at the end of that tournament, I remember somebody walking over to me going and just complimenting me about how well I did. And I thought I actually didn't do well losing the grand championship. Mm-hmm. And he said, do you realize that you defeated 4 of the top 10 fighters today in the nation? And I had no idea who they were. Like, I opened up a magazine. He goes, you defeated this guy, this guy, and this guy on the way to the grand championship. So my first open tournament, I defeated 4 national top 10 fighters, and then from there, I fell in love with it, wanted to start traveling, training with other people. I had phenomenal people to train with in Columbia. We had Mike Genova and Bruce Bucci. We had just had wonderful people to train with, and we started bringing in people like Joe Lewis, flying them in, Bill Wallace, to have seminars. Hmm. And so from the early 70s, I was training with people like Joe Lewis, Bill Wallace. There were so many others, which had a direct impact on my life, because Joe Lewis was the first guy that told me that it was okay to move in the ring. And at that time, karate was so backwards, you were not allowed to step backwards when you fought. And if you did, it was considered a coward's move. Oh. But some tournaments in Texas would even take a point away from you if you backed up. So this new methodology of training, I started working circular movement, and when my fighters would throw, opponents would throw techniques, I just wouldn't be there. I'd be at the edge of the kick and the counter. It's just the mainstay, my sidekicks, my kicking ability, that I learned a lot from Bill Wallace, movement I learned from Joe Lewis. I trained and became just one of those people that would train 3 o'clock in the morning, went all over the country training, and then it wasn't a couple of years later, the first magazine came out, and in the United States, the top fighters all left tournament karate and went over to full-contact karate. And that was Bill Wallace and Joe Lewis and Jeff Smith and all Howard Jackson. So all point fighters left a void. There was no rating system. There was no national tournament scene. And so for a couple of years, all of us in the nation were just fighting locally. I had stepped out a little bit, but when the first black belt ratings came out, and at this time, a couple of years after these great fighters had moved on and transitioned over to full contact, the first ratings came out was the top 10 in the nation. I remember it was yesterday. I picked up the magazine, and the first thing I saw was my name as number 10, and I was so upset. I went, it says alphabetical ratings. But Vitaly being starting with the letter Z was number 10. Dan Anderson was number 1. And even though it's a phenomenal accomplishment to be rated top 10 in the country, I went, you guys have beaten me. How can you be rated over me if they hadn't? So I remember thinking, that was my mindset. I was very competitive. Mm-hmm. And so I went, I will fight each and every one of these guys in the top 10. And guess what? If y'all beat me, God bless them. I deserve to be 10. But there's no way somebody should beat me if they can't beat me. So I went to the internationals. I started traveling. I started training and traveling. And it was a, you know, the first year I won the Mid-Americas, won PK. Now, I just had so many national tournaments in spite of myself that, who knows. But first year, the ratings came out called Karate Illustrators Ratings. And I was rated number 1 in the country. And my nemesis for the next 3 years, Ray McCallum was number 2. And then they had the great fighters. There's so many of them. Larry Kelly, Dan Anderson, Mike Genova. You know, so many of them were in the top 10. And so for the next 3 years, I stayed number 1 in the country. I traveled. I fought everybody. And I retired at the third year, being the rated number 1 fighter in the United States for 3 years in a row. And one of the reasons, and this is a segue into the movie world, is I had done so well and won all the accomplishments, and the new ratings came out, not only had me number 1 for the third year in a row, but it had me as a top 10 fighter of all time. And I decided at that time, I've accomplished everything I wanted to accomplish in the martial arts competitive world. I was rated number 5 in the world full contact. I was number 1 in the world points and tournaments. And therefore, I said, I'd like to pursue something else. And about that time, I had a phone call. And it was at the karate school that I had at the time in Atlanta, Georgia. And my secretary comes out, gets me off the bed and says, there's somebody that wants to speak to you on the phone from California, from Cannon Films. And I said, sure. So I pick up the phone, and it was a lady on the phone, and she said, hi, my name is Priscilla McDonald. I work with Cannon Films. I'd like to offer you a 3-movie deal. We just saw your magazine cover, and I was in 13 covers within those 2 years, so I got a lot of publicity. And my first reaction was, I said, thank you, but tell Mike Genova to kiss my ass. Now, Mike Genova is one of my best friends and one of the top 10 fighters in the nation. Mike plays pranks like this all the time on all of us. I knew he was playing ankle knee, so I hung up on him. Just hung up. 5 minutes later, the phone rings, and I go pick it up. She goes, excuse me, I don't know who this Mike Genova is, but my name is Priscilla McDonald from California. I went, sure you are. She goes, listen, and then we started talking. I went, oh, excuse me, I'm so sorry. But it was Priscilla McDonald, and she said, we want to fly you out. And they did. They flew me out for the first movie called Revenge of the Ninja, Star Wars Shokufuku. And we were going in, and this is when Malcolm Golden had just started. He had only done one movie earlier than this, and it was Enter the Ninja. Mm-hmm. So now, Revenge of the Ninja, and he was on 6464 Sunset Boulevard, which is a tiny little office. Next to his office upstairs was a porno was an awful set they were doing pornos in. I just remember going, oh, this is so low budget. You know, here's a porno company next door. Here's a film company in this room. And we then met Menaka, met Priscilla, met Sam Tristenberg, the director. And they said they didn't want for me to in this movie with Shoko Fuji. And so that is how I transitioned to the arts world. But I asked Priscilla, I said, how did you pick me? And she said, you were on so many covers. There was a cover I was on, Official Karate and Karate Illustrated and a couple others. And she said, you were always looking in Hollywood. They still are, I would imagine. We're always looking for a new look. You're number one in the country. You're the top fighter. We like your look. And let's go from there. So that's exactly how I started.
And imagine if they would have just left you alone after that initial hang-up. you know what I mean? Well, this guy is not cooperating. Let's move on to someone else.
Well, you know, that's not how Hollywood is. Hollywood wants what they can't have most of the time. They're like kids. Mm. And if I had been all over them, you know, who knows? But the fact that I even hung up on them, they wanted me even more. Just, you know, they want something they can't have. They're always looking for that next best thing. And it was kind of a, you know, I go back so, you know, so far back during that time, it was contentious time for Menachem Golan between, get this, but very few people know this. This is when, right after The Ninja, when Mike Stone. Hmm. Mike Stone did that movie in The Ninja. That was his concept. He sold it. That was his baby. He brought with him Shoko Fuji. Hmm. Show worked for Mike. When Mike had a falling out or didn't get the terms or didn't get the money or whatever the case might be, Show went behind him or went into the office and said, don't worry about Mike Stone. I can do this. So you don't have to be concerned about him, and I know I can do a just as good a job, if not a better job. And so my husband said, sure, let's go with you and forget Mike Stone, which I know Mike Stone, and I didn't know him at the time, but I knew that was a very touchy subject to bring up, his relationship with Shoko Fuji, because he felt always that Show was part of his stunt team, and Show went basically behind his back and did this. But look at the Hollywood. I mean, I'm not part of the Hollywood scene. I lived in Atlanta. I didn't really know how they operated. But Show was, he was a very dynamic force, but he was an extremely controlling person. Mm-hmm. And he had been pre-production preparing for the film for maybe 6 months. And he had not only arranged and put together maybe 50 different weapons, he made weapons, and he had everything ready. And part of his deal with Cannon Films is that they would have to buy his weapons and incorporate his weapons within the film, which they did. Hmm. And the strangest thing is, I've done a lot of films, been set. It was actually my second one, because my first film I said I ever was on, I was a stuntman on Forge 5, which is phenomenal. I mean, I was there living at the time. I went to stay with Bill Wallace, who tried to get the starred role and auditioned for it, lost the starring role to Joe Louis, and then they went ahead and hired Richard Norton, Benny Yakitis, and others. And it was a small-budgeted film by Spouse, but it was a phenomenal cast of fighters, had the top 50 fighters around the world as stuntmen in that movie. So I had a little bit of exposure in a film, and I had fought Louis and Richard Norton in film, but only as a stuntman in a white gi. Nobody knew who I was. But in this production, that was my first on the Show Kasugi. But Show was extremely controlling. Show would argue with the director about the limit of takes other actors could get, and he wanted to make sure that he was the only one to incorporate weapons. And one time the director said, well, let's keep giving weapons, let him do a weapon. Uh-huh. And I remember Show almost just on a test tantrum. No, Keith can't touch a weapon. Uh-huh. In fact, we won't keep the dies as though Keith has to have his hands cut off. And I remember going to the director's going, no, we're not killing Keith off or cutting his hands off. And Show goes, no, we must, you know, it was one of those. He really wanted me to die in this film and get killed off. But it was fine. It was my first one. I just stayed out to the side. But I loved working with Show because he was talented. He had great technique. And truly, if anybody was obsessed about being a ninja, Show believed he was a ninja. He was reincarnated as a ninja, believed he was a ninja. And I'd always joke with him about him believing that he was a ninja. Because he truly got so involved in the role. But guess what? That's what all great actors do. Look at Tom Cruise. When he takes a new role on, he really takes that personality on. and he becomes that person. Well, Sho did the same thing in the ninja role. And he played not only the good ninja, but people don't realize this. You know, in the scene, there's a ninja with a black mask, and there's a ninja that Arthur Roberts played with a white mask, or vice versa. Anyway, Sho Kasugi played both parts.
Yeah.
At times, we had to fight each other. He's his own stunt guy. But every time he saw them independently, individually, it was Sho playing both parts.
That's creativity that extends to even non-action and martial arts movies. When you spoke of that, I remember watching Peter Jackson's first movie, Bad Taste, where he actually has a fight scene with himself on a mountain cliff. So
right.
You just throw yourself into it, and if you believe in it, if you have the heart and passion and drive right. for it, you do make it work. Revenge of the Ninja, I mean, he Sho truly stands out as a presence. You're not wrong there at all, and that still survives in 2013 as we are in now.
Well, guess what, Ken? Even today, when I've gone around the world, and I went to a couple of years ago, there's a good many of us, the Don Wilsons and St. the Rothwatch, Richard Norton, there's a bunch of us. All of us got together, and we flew to Berlin for a film festival they had there. And people remember Revenge of the Ninja. Mm-hmm. It amazed me how much people remember this film from all over the world. So this, let me tell you how much of an impact this movie made. When it first came out, my experience was this, and nobody can even have any inkling of an idea. The entire process, I thought it was the worst movie ever made in the history of movies.
Wow.
The movie was so violent. It was so theatrical, over the top, and the show was always, you know, doing, you know, he had five weapons on him, and I'd go, where did his weapons come from? In the middle of a scene, he'd take out, you know, his axe, and I'd go, where did that axe come from? You know, I'm like watching him, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is embarrassing. And then he'd move, and then next thing he'd take out something like the size of a car, and he'd use it. I'd go, am I the only one seeing this? And so I thought not only was it, to my first film, I didn't have a lot to compare it to, but I was, oh gosh, I've never seen so much blood and violence on a set in my life. I'm totally amazed that how bad I thought this movie was being made, how awful it was. Now, one thing that it did have was great stunts. Mm-hmm. We have a guy named Steve Lambert, who was our stunt coordinator, who was phenomenal. He was the best I'd ever seen. Of course, I was new, but all these years, he's still the best I've ever worked with. And the reason I say that, one of our scenes was between two tall towers, Los Angeles. Now, these towers go up, let's say, 50 floors. And they connected the towers with some kind of wire. Mm-hmm. And then he had to go from one tower into the next tower, you know, with his hands holding on to the device, kick through the window. And I remember watching him do that going, it's phenomenal. It looks incredible. But my initial reaction was, it was the most violent movie I had ever seen. Because at the time, this was in the 70s, Sam Peckinpah had just come out with a couple of movies of violence. But other than that, you didn't see a lot of over-the-top blood and movies. Mm-hmm. Even in the Asian world, it wasn't over-the-top the way this movie was. And they shot two versions. One had a lot of blood and a little nudity. The other version was more R-rated. It had quite the nudity or blood. Mm-hmm. But I remember this. I remember the movie miraculously, I mean, it's hard to believe this happened, but in the course of making the movie, MGM does a deal with Canon Films, which put him on the map, and mm-hmm. said, here's what we'll do. We like this movie, Revenge of the Ninja. We're going to give it, for the first time ever, a full domestic theatrical release.
Wow.
And they took out probably 10 times, 15 times more in money for theatrical for print and advertising than they did for making the film. There were full-page ads in every newspaper in the United States. It was in every major theater in the United States. And when this movie hit, let me tell you how much I did know. Yeah, it makes sense when you think about how popular MMA is today. But at that time, I thought it was so over-the-top, so over-theatrical and bloody that I was not prepared. They even had a premiere for me personally in Atlanta, and they actually had a premiere for the film in Los Angeles. It was two big premieres, MGM paid. They paid for my own premiere here in Atlanta. But get this, when this movie premiered, no one, I guarantee your audience is going to be blown away by this. But when this movie premiered, Variety this week, or I'm sorry, Variety Movie Magazine comes out. What they do is they rate the top movies of the week or the month or whatever. And out of these movies, you would have never thought this, but Risky Business, mm-hmm. it was a big movie. Flashdance was a big movie. Mm-hmm. Trading Places was a big movie. Return of the Jedi is a big movie.
Yes.
Mr. Mom, Easy Money. Now, these are all major A movies. I mean, think about Return of the Jedi. Guess what? Revenge of the Ninja, out of all these movies, was the third top grossing film in Variety that week.
Wow.
Now, when you think about Flashdance and Return of the Jedi, think about Risky Business with Tom Cruise. Guess what? The impact that one movie, that Revenge of the Ninja, had on this nation, most people have no clue. But you can see the relevance when you see, when I read out the names, and you can, I can see that the whole country was enamored by this. Then all of a sudden, there were literally thousands upon thousands of sales of, guess what, ninja, black ninja outfits all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
People buying ninja outfits, dressing in ninja outfits, and watching Revenge of the Ninja at home. It was a ninja craze.
You wonder if this was something that MGM kind of saw or took a chance on. I mean, Enter the Ninja had been made, yes, but it was not circulating in the mainstream in a large way, I suppose. So I just wonder if MGM had did a 50-50 chance deal.
Guess what? They knew more than me. I thought it was going to be an embarrassing flop. As a matter of fact, I had an interview after the premiere in Atlanta, and I learned my lesson, but I learned it well. I said in my first interview, and the press came to me after the movie. It was the most bloody movie I'd ever seen at the time. I was, oh, my gosh. I said, look, I apologize. I had no idea it was this much violence and this much blood. And you know a big friend of that? And you know, I don't know how this works, but within 12 hours, it wasn't even the full 24 hours, I had Priscilla McDonald calling me up from Cannes Films in Los Angeles, yelling at me, screaming at me, don't you ever, ever criticize a book that you're in ever again.
Wow.
And I learned my lesson. I mean, and I did. I went, oh, my gosh. She says, you talk about how great this movie is.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, you know something? I did this. Let's go 10 years later. I'm working with a company, and they're producing videos. I did a self-defense case we'll talk about later, and mm-hmm. it was went out nationwide. But anyway, I was promoting the video, and when I would go to these video stores around the country, I made one mistake. Some fan came to me, getting my autograph, and talked about one of the movies I had done. And one of the movies I thought was easy, and I said something to that effect. And I went, yeah, it's not that great of a movie. Well, the store owner pulled me to the side. And you know, the store owner said the same thing Priscilla McDonald said. She said, Keith, I don't care if you like your movies or not, but these fans will love your movies.
Mm.
Don't you ever put another movie down again. I went, you know, that's great advice. I learned. I mean, you have to learn. And I went, my gosh, just promote what you do. And guess what? If it's not the best movie, it's like a child people pick on. You know, you should love that child at least. And so I grew personally. I learned. It took a couple of people to point out to me, it doesn't matter what you think about these films. What's important is how much people love these films. And, you know, so this revenge, my son, believe it or not, loves this film. This is one of his favorite films. And when he was growing up, here's what he would do. I had a dying scene in Revenge of the Ninja. Shokasuki kills me. He's the good ninja. So I have a scene with him. As I'm dying, he has to go change clothes and put on the bad ninja outfit, the mask. So he comes. It's really funny. And we dialogue. And my dialogue is cheesy. And again, it's my first film, the dialogue. And I'm going, not bad first time out, part of my dialogue. Anyway, it's cheesy. It's okay. I don't care. I mean, it's okay. But anyway, my son, every time we were growing up, like he'd be 8, 9 years old, and he'd get in trouble. And I'd go, Travis, come over here. I can't believe you did that or whatever. Go to your room. He would fall on the ground, then do my entire dying scene for Revenge of the Ninja. And he'd go, and I'd laugh so hard, he would never get in trouble because I'd be laughing my head off. And he knew my entire dying scene by heart.
Wow. how long did it? I mean, as someone who's working from the inside on a production, it is sometimes hard to get an external perspective on the movie. But did you quickly learn to appreciate the movie, or did it take 10 years before you truly could see it from the outside?
No. You know, I still look at it in the same way. I still look at it as it's extremely theatrical, bloody. Not the violence. I don't mind the violence, but I still go when I see like show pull out an axe or a sword or something, or you know something where, wait a minute, we just saw him get in the swimming pool or hot tub, and he came out and he's got 14 weapons. Where'd they come from? See, I'm too analytical, and I'm like. You know, whereas you're not supposed to be, you're supposed to just watch it and enjoy it or whatever. And when you're in the process of doing it, so still today, I'm looking at that, I still look at it in a way that I think that while the world loves it and it's a great film and it's done financially great, you know, I don't compare it the same way I compare it to my work with Vinya Kitas and Jackie Chan and Sammo Hung and Young Bao and Wills O'Mills. Mm-hmm. Now, here's a total contrast. The entire time I'm on the set, I'm watching this film being made with these great guys, I'm thinking it's the best thing I have ever seen in my life. Mm-hmm. And there's no editing, special effects, or music, which add, of course, to the emotional effect when you're watching a film. But just in its raw form itself, as we're shooting it, it's still the best thing I have ever seen. And I went, oh, my God. So this film, I thought it was going to be as big as Revenge of the Ninja, or biggest thing ever, because, oh, my gosh, these guys were so talented.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's segue into the next year, as you got cast in the Sammo Hung director Wheels on Meals with Jackie Chan, Sammo, and Yung Bu. And me knowing a little bit about behind the scenes shenanigans of Hong Kong cinema, it's all played very loose sometimes. So I'm curious, how did the casting process go on this one? Because if we put things in perspective, this was a heavy duty production decade for Hong Kong cinema, and my take on it is that I don't think, and feel free to correct me, I don't think you saw a script outline before or even during production, or am I wrong on that?
No, you're exactly right. You know, and that's the whole thing. It's funny because I asked for a script on the way down there as we're flying, and a friend of mine, his name is Pat Johnson, very well known in the States. He was a great fighter, great martial artist, and he was a stunt coordinator for a good many movies, and just phenomenal person. Anyway, he called me up and said he knew Jackie, and Jackie had asked for me personally, because at the time I was the number one fighter in the country. And what Jackie liked to do was have the top American martial artist of the time in his films. Wonderful. I'm more than honored to go out there and work with these guys. And no script, but at the same time, it was their production's largest production value of the time. They had just moved up to another stage. They were doing a bunch of films, and this was the highest budget they had ever done it themselves. Mm-hmm. And they were shooting a location in Barcelona, Spain, and they know what they're doing, even though the cast doesn't know. All we know is we get to the set, we have this dialogue, we have these techniques to put together and perform. That's it. We don't know what's going on. We have no idea how it's connected from one scene to the next or what the movie's about at all. And one of my best experiences ever. And as I taught stunt acting film camps for 10 years with Keith Sternberg and Michael DeFazzoli, we had a film camp, and people from all over the world would come in, and we teach people how to break into films and how to fight according to stunt fighting. And I always shared with everybody one of the best lessons I learned from Jackie Chan himself. And we're getting ready to shoot a scene. Sammo Hung's the director. The camera's there. The crew's there. We're on location. And everything's set to go, and Sammo looks at me and says, "Are you ready, Keith?" And I went, "Am I ready? I don't know what I'm doing. I mean, what are we getting ready to do?" He says, "No problem. Work with Jackie." So Jackie pulls me to the side, and he goes, "Keith, throw some kicks for me." And I threw some kicks. I threw some movements. And he goes, "Very good, very good. I can work with you very well." And I said, "So what are we going to do?" He goes, "I want you to, he says, hold on one thing. Hold on for one second. And right in front of me, he sat down, he took his hand, and imagine, playing the drums on his leg. So just imagine, he's working out a beat on his leg. And he was going, one, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, one, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three. And I asked him, I said, what are you doing? He says, I'm working on the beat of the film. I said, the beat? He goes, yes, the beat is the most important thing. Hmm. He says, imagine, Keith, you take the two best fighters in the world, you put them in a fight scene together, but if there's not a beat, a rhythm, he says, you're watching from subconscious mind, and you don't know why you won't like it, but you won't like it, because there's not a natural rhythm, a flow. And I'm sitting there, I wish I had a book, I wanted to start taking notes, it was like being in college. Yeah. And he says, well, you want a fight scene is you want to develop a rhythm, a natural that has a beat. So he worked the beat of the film out. Now, that's so foreign to Western choreographers and fighters. You know, we're almost, the director, you know, the stunt coordinator says, throw a punch, throw a kick, fall on the ground, or whatever. But imagine the sophistication, how much more advanced Jackie Chan was from the rest of the world at this stage. And where he understood rhythm, he understood beats, he understood movement. I was like a kid in a candy store. So we worked out the beat, we put it together, and it was beautiful. I enjoyed it when I was doing it. Forget about the music later. The music and the editing adds to it. But, this is phenomenal. This is an experience.
And I've always said, as a fan of both Sammo's and Jackie's, and knowing a little bit of their differences in feel in terms of action at this time, I always enjoyed Sammo having a lot of powerful action, and especially when working with Jackie, and we're talking harder, literally harder action, that then leads into the thought that Sammo probably insisted, even on this movie, on not even semi-contact, maybe even full contact. How was it, as a matter of fact? Were you taking hard hits, or...?
You understand more about this genre than anybody I've spoken to so far, because these are phenomenal questions. You were right on. You understand Sammo Hung. Sammo Hung wasn't about only aesthetic beauty. His was about the power. Mm-hmm. And being the director, get this, it was an avid sport bettor. They bet on everything. They played cards. They bet on, and him and Jackie would bet. And sometimes during the course of shooting this movie, they'd be angry at each other and be mad at each other. And they would stop the production and go bet and come back, and then they'd be yelling at each other. I mean, it was quite an experience. But one time, now get this, Vinny is fighting. Here's a scene, and I love this story. Everything is set up for the scene, and there's a tractor in the scene, and we're on some kind of field, and Samuel's the director. He's going to be in the scene, too. But anyway, it starts off with Vinny is fighting Jackie Chan. And Jackie is supposed to do a few moves and then do a jump spinning kick over Benny's head. Mm-hmm. Before he's to do a 360 and land, I'm to come into the set, break into the set, and then hit him with a sliding side kick. Full power and knock him down. Mm-hmm. So everything, I look at it, Jackie says, can you do that? And I went, of course I can do it. No problem. Jackie Chan looks at me and says, I'm ready. Let's shoot it. So I put my right side forward. I'm a better right side kicker than left side. And everybody's set. There's 100 people watching this, plus the producer from Hong Kong is on the set this day, too. And there's people there. It's a phenomenal set. Everybody's excited. And right before we get ready to shoot, Sammo Hung looks at me and says, what are you doing? I went, I'm ready. No, change sides. He says, see the camera? The camera wants to see your face, not your back. And I looked at him and I said, oh, no, Sammo. You much rather have me hit Jackie with a full side kick in my right foot because I can control it better than my left. He just said something in Chinese and yelled at me. I changed sides. No problem. I can do it. So anyway, I changed sides. And we did maybe 10 takes. All 10 takes dropped Jackie Chan to the ground. All 10 takes, I thought I killed him. All 10 takes, some of them he was crying as hard as anybody can cry. All 10 takes, they were yelling at me. The stunt people yelling at me. Everybody was yelling at me, but guess what Sammo said every time? He'd look at me and smile, and right before the next take, he looked at me, you know what he said? I'll never forget. He goes, power. More power.
Yeah.
And I go, and then Jackie would look over at him and get mad because he said more power. And then I did the next take. I slide up, And before he could land from doing that 360 aerobatic movement, I would catch him so hard in the chest with my sidekick, and I would just knock him back like you wouldn't believe. So I would knock him back to the ground. He would fall to the ground and be holding himself. It's my fault. I mean, but he wouldn't wear a pad. And I couldn't pull the punch because of the angle of the cameras. It's like we teach, you know, you don't have to hit somebody. Oh, no. Samuel was about the power. So he was hurt so bad that we didn't film for 2 days. I knew we weren't going to film. I said, because my last one, I caught him in the throat. And everybody was mad at me, except Samuel wasn't mad at me. And as a matter of fact, 3 days later, he calls me up and says, come to the set. I have a scene for you, just for you. And he says, I love your psychic. There's a scene where he has his Volkswagen bus. And he says, this guy is, these two guys were very famous. And forgive me, I don't know their names, but they were very famous Hong Kong comedians that were in this. One of them was supposed to open up the door, and I'm standing on the ground from this Volkswagen bus. As the door slides open, I grab the guy, and I flip him over my head, and he falls to the ground. The next guy comes up and jumps on to confront me. Samuel says, Keith, here's what I want you to do. Slide up, hit this guy with a sidekick. Can you pick him up and throw him back into the bus and hit the bus and make the bus rock? And I said, sure, I can do that. So they took a mattress, and what they did was they tied a mattress to the back of the bus, inside the bus. And I'm supposed to hit this little Asian guy, pick him up, slam him into the back of the bus. So the interpreter, because everybody spoke Chinese, I mean American, but a little bit of Jackie and a little bit of Samo and a little bit of Yuan. So anyway, I told the guy to go up when he jumps out of the bus and lands on the ground, and then go for 1 foot to take the weight off so it's for me to pick him up. He understood. So Samo says, actually, I take the first guy, I throw him, the guy jumps down, I slide up, I hit him with a sidekick so hard. He goes into the bus, and the bus is rocking. And then he just collapses. I walk away, and Jack Samuel goes, where are you going? Come back. I went, oh, look, he's dead. He can't shoot anymore. And Samuel said, no problem, we have more Chinese. And there was a line of Chinese stuntmen, and they were all speaking in Chinese, scratching their head, going, wow, they were all upset. Because they all had to take a turn for me kicking them. I had to go one at a time and kick each one of them.
Wow.
and get this, so I had already knocked out Jackie. I had taken this guy out. So in one of my scenes with Samo, I'm doing the double scene. I'm fighting Yuan Bao and Samo at the same time. And, so what happens is, this is the one where now Samo comes and we're in the castle and he spits sword around, he can spear around. And anyway, I have to do a jump spinning kick, break the sword, break his spear, and then do a jump spinning kick him in the head, and then that's how that scene's supposed to end. Well, we shot it 50 times. 50 times.
Wow.
It had 6, 8, 10 moves, and all of it is me jumping and kicking and ducking weapons, and it was a very intricate move. And I loved it. I had to change my suit twice because it was soaking wet. Sometimes the camera wouldn't pick it up properly, or whatever the case might be, but Samuel one is perfect. And one of the takes, I did a jump spinning kick. Instead of breaking the spear, I caught him square in the head with a jump spinning kick. Knocked Samuel out unconscious. When he went out unconscious, all of us stood like in our seats without moving. Because you're not supposed to stop until the director says stop. And it says cut. But anyway, Samuel's the director. He's out unconscious, and nobody's saying cut, and nobody will move. So we're frozen. Finally, Samuel wakes up, goes, cut, cut. And when he stands up, I went, oh, he's going to kill me. He's going to fire me. He hugs me in a bear hug so hard.
Wow.
He loved it. He loved it. He hugged me, and then he screamed in Chinese to all of the stunt people. And I assumed he would, if I can take it and get knocked out, you can take it too.
It doesn't surprise me in the least that this was the attitude on set, that they realized that this would make for the type of cinema that us fans have loved and still love for so many years, because there's no way to fake any of this stuff, and we kind of suffer, but they suffer for our enjoyment as well, and you can never fake that, and it's just wonderful to hear.
I have one more. This is the third part of the story. And Benny was phenomenal working with Jackie, and this fight scene was just phenomenal, above aesthetic beauty watching these two go at it. But in the course of that, I had my own engine fight scene with Yong Bao, and I got along with him really well. I got along with everybody, but he was wonderful. And he kept on telling me he liked my style of fighting more than Benny's. Mm-hmm. Benny's 5'5", and he's short, and he uses a lot of short techniques. And they're beautiful, but they're powerful. I'm taller, and I have long, circular, aesthetic movements, you know, and I can do the spins and the jumps. So Yong Bao liked my style of fighting better than Benny's, he kept telling me. So he ended the fight scene with me, which we did. So in the course of the fight scene, before we get started, the entire crew comes here, Jackie and Sabo and Yong Bao, and all of a sudden, everybody's here. And they're all laughing. And I said, what's going on? And then Samuel explains to me, it's my last scene. I said, well, great. He goes, here's what we're going to do. You have knocked me out, not Yong Bao out, because I had hurt him in the scene as well with a round kick. He said, you've knocked all of us out. You've hurt all of us. And he was laughing. I said, well, I apologize. So he says, it's our time for you now. I said, well, what are you going to do? He goes, in this scene, Yong Bao is going to take this pit. It's going to be filled with wine, and he's going to smash it over your head. And he showed me a tray. There's five ceramic pitchers on there. And he just filled them. I felt them. I went, Samuel, this will kill me. This is not breakaway. This is real, real ceramic. He goes, here's a knife. Chisel some ceramic out if you want. But you're going to be hitting your head. And if you don't do a good job, I'll hit you with all of these. I went, oh, good. So we filmed the scene. He hits me over the head in the final take. And if you see it closely, you see me smile because I'm thinking, I'm the dumbest person alive to allow him to knock me out because I was totally knocked out on the film. He hit me so hard. Imagine if it was a plastic container of milk carton, a milk, and somebody hit you in the head with a plastic half gallon of milk, it could still hurt you.
Yeah.
But imagine ceramic. Oh, my gosh, it really hurt. So when I got knocked out, I woke up, the entire set, everybody was clapping for me. They were all happy. And I went, oh. Yeah, so when you said Samuel likes, and he likes realism, and oh my God, I had no idea.
It's that difference between Jackie's and Samuel's styles that it's great that they have different styles, because in Samuel's movies, if you want to be truly honest about it, it's more violence in Samuel's movies, and Jackie has always said his movies has action. And you never find any violent streaks as such in Jackie's movies, but that's why I enjoy him being directed by Samuel, because it's I don't know, I like these actors and performers to be hurt for my enjoyment, but I don't know, I just find it more pleasurable. But on that fight scene with Yung-Yu, which lasts for a few minutes in the scene in the movie, they cut back and forth between Jackie and Benny's fight. But do you remember how many days it took to film that Yung-Yu fight scene?
Sure. It took about 7 days.
Uh-huh.
And it was beautiful to watch. And, you know, Benny and Jackie had a little bit of friction on the set during the making of their fight scene. What happened was, you know, when you do a fight scene, you have a master shot, and then you have to do over the shoulder sometimes, but then you come in for the close-ups. Mm-hmm. It was during these close-ups where you show the actual hitting of the techniques that there was some friction, and that's when Benny is something else. Benny, when I was number one, five in the world full contact fighter, Benny was number one in the world full contact fighter, my same division. Mm-hmm. And we would train together, all set. Benny, I hit Benny with things that would kill somebody, hurt somebody. And Benny would look at me and wouldn't even be fazed. I said, Benny, you don't feel pain. He doesn't feel pain. I hit Benny in the head with full power round kicks, right in full power, nose and head. And my shins would hurt before his head would hurt. He just didn't feel pain. So in the course of the shooting the scene, now there's one scene where Jen is backing up Benny, and he's hitting him with uppercuts and hooks. And now they want to show that he's really hitting him in the face, and they're going to do close-ups. So they come in real tight with the cameras, and Samuel looks at Benny. He says, Benny, he says, I'm going to let Jackie hit you sometimes in the face. Is that okay? And here's what Benny says. No problem. And which, in some way, can be interpreted as disrespectful. And so, because that's all Benny ever said, but he didn't mean it disrespectful-wise.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was, when they went to do the first five, six moves, Jackie goes left, right, uppercut, left, right, and hits Vinny with all these techniques. Someone goes, cut, cut. Vinny says, Vinny, you okay? Vinny says, no problem. Inferring that Jackie doesn't have any power. So he says, again. So then Jackie picks up the pace and starts hitting him harder and harder. And I mean, full power right in the face. You see, man, just, oh my goodness. Samuel says, cut, cut. Vinny, you okay? He goes, no problem. He kept those the same thing over and over. And they did this for one hour. And I said, Vinny, something different. Do something different. Because you pissed him off Jackie. So finally, Jackie got mad. And then Jackie says, one day I will challenge you to a fight. And then Vinny says, what did you say? He said, I'll come to your country. I'll fight you in a full contact fight. Because they were like getting angry. Uh-huh. And I said, Jackie, please, listen to me. I said, you're an actor. Vinny's a fighter. I said, you do not want to be fighting a fighter. And he just looked at me. I said, no sense. I said, you do not want to fight this man. And they kind of clapped. And then he saved face. He did something. But it was a way that we had to allow Jackie to look good in front of his crew, because his crew, Jackie thought he was looking bad in front of his crew, because every time he'd hit this guy, he felt that Vinny Ukitis was mocking him, thinking that he didn't have any power. But it wasn't any of that. Vinny was just letting the director know he wasn't hurt, and Vinny was taking that as, oh, you're not hurt because I have no power. And that wasn't the case at all. Mm. But Jackie's probably the most talented person I'd ever seen in my life, until I met Samuel. I thought Samuel was the most talented person. Jackie would ask me things like, he says, what do you think if I run up this wall? And I went, well, you can't run up a wall. He goes, of course I can. And he would show me he could run up a wall. I go, that is impossible. And then it's my opinion. He goes, in this castle scene, I have to break into the castle to rescue him. And I went, because I've been there and I'm tied up. He goes, how should I do that? And I looked at the castle as a night shoot. It was an old castle. And it's an authentic castle that's 1,000 years old. And I said, Benny, Jackie, we don't know how you can get in there. He says, what if I took these sticks? And he grabbed two sticks, and he started jumping them and put them in holes and going up. And I went, this could be the most talented martial artist ever to live. I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah, in subsequent movies, Jackie almost uses those moments, climbing walls or what have you, as kind of throwaway moments. I don't know if you remember the moment in Police Story where he climbs a gate, and he takes two, three leaps, and he's over the stone wall and the gate, and it's over in a millisecond almost. It's like he's not weighing anything, it seems like.
You're exactly right. I get this. One time I told the director, Samuel, I said, Samuel, why don't you put the castle in your shot more? I mean, we're shooting, but he's not even showing a castle that's over 1,000 years old. And he goes, that's not old. Well, from America's perspective, if we had a castle here, it'd be roped and you'd be charging admission to come see it. In your country, I'm a history major in college. I majored in English history. I know how far English history goes back, but Chinese history goes back thousands of years. And so his perspective was, why put a castle in that movie? It's not even an old castle. Mm. I mean, it's not even old to him. And I was like, no, you're right about Jackie. Jackie could do things with so little effort that was his secret. He could just, it was a phenomenal, but he was trained in that school that he was trained with his brothers, Samuel and Young Dylan. They were real young, and they talked about it all the time. And the problem on the set was they couldn't ever speak down to the bigger brother. The big brother is Samuel, so Jackie has to listen to everything Samuel says without arguing. Mm-hmm. He has to say yes, yes. And then Young has to say the same thing to Jackie, because Jackie was his big brother while they were there. And I'd ask Jackie, I go, well, Jackie, what? He said, Keith, I can't. He's my big brother. I can't say anything to him. Like, oh my goodness, this is a whole different culture.
Yeah, and going in this production as the Westerner, I mean, I don't know if you had any sense of that Hong Kong cinema, action cinema, was thriving at the time, but regardless, did you take this as a kind of personal challenge, new movie in an Eastern movie, I'm a Westerner, I'm going, did you feel you had something to prove, or how does your mind work?
No, good question. Again, I did, because very few of us had ever had the opportunity to work with agents. And again, here's the difference. The American directors are more concerned about the impact of the blow. They see a consequence for the movement. So at the end of a, you throw a haymaker, a very powerful punch or kick, you want to see the direct reaction to that fight. Like, if it's powerful, you want to see that fighter fall. Steven Seagal, when he hits somebody, they crumple, they break, he kills them. But the aesthetic beauty of a character from Hong Kong, they're not interested in the power as much as they are the aesthetic beauty of the technique. Mm-hmm. And they want to see the flow and the rhythm and want to see it go back and forth and back and forth. And that was part of my problem when I became a producer working with N.G. Ewan with some of the directors in these other films with Keith Sternberg. Keith Sternberg and I started producing films, and we had Chinese productions, Chinese crew, Chinese directors, but the American actors, like Gary Daniels, for example, they wanted the director to allow them to show their power. So, for example, he says, Keith, I'm throwing powerful kicks, and every time I'm throwing kicks, this fighter just jumps back up like I'm not hurt. He says, I will give this director money if he allows me, just please, one time, throw a kick, and the fighter actually just fall. Mm-hmm. You see the difference? So the Westerner directors, they want to see the power, the technique, and see you react very quickly from the consequence of the blow. Whereas the Hong Kong director, they want to see multiple techniques and rhythm and beauty and aesthetic flow. And sometimes a fighter will throw 15 powerful kicks that you would think would take a fighter, but it didn't even tase them. They're still fighting. Mm-hmm. And working with these in the Ewing films, Super Fights and Never Treat Us Green. Then not only that, I did Blood Moon as well with Gary Daniels. I did three movies with the Chinese production team. All three times, that was part of the problem, was that I would try to convince the director, and the one director I had did not have a good time with was Lucas Lowe, and whereas Tony Leung I loved, and he would understand what I was saying. Mm-hmm. But when I would argue with Lucas Lowe, I'd go, Let's show some power in our techniques. I said, Americans like to see when we throw a kick, and it's a powerful kick, that there's a reaction. The guy gets hit and he falls. And Lucas looked at me and he goes, Keith, I am not making this for America. I am making this for Hong Kong. I don't care what you think. Hmm. And that's the argument we would get into all the time.
So we'll cut the interview right there for this part one. So I hope you all enjoyed hearing those tales of Keith working on Revenge of the Ninja, Wheels on Meals, and you heard, of course, him briefly mentioning working for Seasonal and the likes of No Retreat, No Surrender 3, Blood Moon, and Super Fights. And we will talk more of that in part two of this interview coming up on Podcast on Fire 158. So I hope you all enjoyed, and I'd like to say thank you to Keith Vitale for taking time out of his busy schedule to chat with us. So this has been Podcast on Fire on the Podcast on Fire Network website. For this, all the other shows and the bonus episodes, podcastonfire.com. Email for feedback, podcastonfire@googlemail.com. Join us over at Facebook, facebook.com/PUF Network. Join the discussion group by typing in Podcast on Fire Network in the search box, or click a link on the page that I just said, and join us over at Twitter, twitter.com/podcastonfire. My writing and video reviewing, sogoodreviews.com and SleazyKVideo.com, and my tweets at twitter.com/sogoodreviews. Subscribe to the Podcast on Fire Network on iTunes, and specifically Podcast on Fire. And if you like the show, please leave a rating and a comment. We would very much be thankful for that. And if you want to stream the podcasts, you can do that as well via the application Stitcher, available to your iPhone, iPad, or Android, and even BlackBerry. And once you're in Stitcher, type in Podcast on Fire Network, and that will get you the chance to add each show individually. And this has been Kennedy for Podcast on Fire 156. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and see you next time.